Physicist and a mathematician, although at least I can't always talk to you. But, by way of introducing what they're going to say, that there's not much to say except for what it's worth. When I was thinking about string theory and what string theory really meant and what M theory would be and so on, I found it work extremely interesting. And it's one of the few pieces of work that asks in a deep way the question of why symmetry, why these special connections 6, 10, 11, and so forth. And so I think it's very good that we have them here for a week with us, and I look forward to their comments. And they're both talking, I don't know in which order.
I worry about back and forth. We often feel that we're identical particles and we exchange at random. What we'd like to do is try to convince you that the basic symmetries of the universe are all embedded in the exceptional Jordan algebra, which is the algebra 3x3 Hermitian matrices whose entries are octonions. And I think I'm assuming correctly that not everyone in the room knows even what octonions are, or certainly not comfortable working with them. Is that a fair assumption? Okay. So we'll start out and try to be very self-contained and start out by telling you what the octonions are and how to work with them. This is actually a very interesting topic because practically every famous physicist that you know has written one paper on the octonions. Many famous physicists have written one paper on the octonions. And then they have a tendency to throw up their hands because the octonions are not associative. And so there are always problems with what order you write things in, which is familiar to physicists because of non-commutativity, but there's also where to put the parentheses and what order you multiply it. And so there's a little bit of a learning curve in terms of getting into the octonions that really throws people off. And in particular, it's been known for a long time how to do the algebras with octonions, but the Lie groups, if you don't have associativity, you can't exponentiate and you can't get from the Lie algebra to the Lie group. And so most of the things that you kind of know and love tend to disappear on you when you work over the octonions. So what we have today to share with you is one really, really solid result, which is how to exponentiate and get from the algebras to groups when you have octonions and this non-associativity going on, so that when you come, it comes to be your turn to write your one paper on the octonions, you don't have to stop there. We can at least tell you how to solve that particular problem. From there, what we'd like to go on, and along the way we'll show you some intriguing things about supersymmetries and particular numbers and dimensions. Then what we'd like to do is talking about something which is a little bit more speculative, which is to go back to the 2x2 matrices over the octonions and show that you're really looking at 10 dimensions when you're doing octonionic things, but that there's a very natural way of getting from 10 dimensions down to 4 without compactification. And there's a unique way, which I think is, you know, particularly beautiful. And one of the biggest problems with string theory is that there are so many ways of getting down to 4 dimensions, how do you know which one to pick? This has a unique way of getting down to 4 dimensions. And when you do that, you discover that you have a part of the spectrum of 3 leptons. And so we'll show you how that works. And then we have some speculation about how to, if you're doing 2x2 things, you get leptons. If you go back up to the 3x3 things and look at the exceptional Jordan algebra, can you get from there to mesons and baryons and all the rest of the things that we'd like to have? And at that stage, the talk gets quite speculative, but also quite fun. So first, let me talk to you, you know, at a very basic level about what the octonions are. It turns out that there are 4 norm to division algebras, the real numbers and the complex numbers, which are very familiar, the quaternions, which are somewhat less familiar. But you, just as you can think of the complex numbers as a pair of real numbers, you can think of the quaternions as a pair of complex numbers by adding another square root of -1, which we will call J for historical reasons. And then you can get from the quaternions to daltonians by taking a pair of quaternions and adding another square root minus one called L, and all the things that you get by multiplying these things out. So the daltonians are eight-dimensional real vector space, the quaternions are four-dimensional ones. The simple complex numbers are a two-dimensional real vector space. And what will be intriguing throughout this talk is the role of then quaternionic and octonionic phases. So we have these things, but what you need to know is how to do algebra with them. Addition, just like with complex numbers, is you add things with similar labels on them. But what we really need to know about is a multiplication rule. Okay, so for the quaternions, the multiplication rule is quite familiar from cross products. And the language I have and J hat and K hat is a leftover from, there's a big battle about whether or not quaternions or vectors would be used to describe E and M. Vectors 1L, but the I hats and J hats and K hats that we use as labels are leftover from that rule. So the multiplication rule is for these square roots minus 1 is that I times J is K if you go in the direction of the arrow around the circle, but if you go outside the direction of the arrow. And J times I is minus K. And you notice right away with the quaternions that you've lost commutativity. That doesn't bother physicists very much. But now let's talk about the octonionic multiplication table. Now I have seven different square roots of minus one, and I have to tell you how to multiply them together. I have I times J is K, so there is a quaternionic subspace sitting inside of the octonions. And now to make I need to add an extra square root of minus one called L. And now I need to know what L times I is and L times K is and all those sorts of things. But I'm running out of letter names, so I'll just call I times L the new thing IL, JL, and KL. Each of these lines you want to think of as a quaternionic subspace in and of its own right. And so we have, in particular, notice that we have three quaternionic subspaces that intersect with this special thing called L. And then put the rest of the units in, and this is actually the seven-point projective plane. And so there's a whole extra level of mathematics there that we're not going to be talking about today. But the octonions also have a lot to do with projective spaces. That's the thing you want to do in mathematics is buried in octonions somewhere. So this is the multiplication rule, and you can program this in your computer and you can multiply octonions and life is fine. Okay. Let me point out in particular that if I take control in Canada, one uses a hockey stick. If we want to multiply I times J and then times L, notice these three things do not lie on the line. They're not in a quaternionic subspace. If I multiply I times J first, I get I times J is K, and then K times L is KL. But if I do it in the other order, if I do J times L first, that gives me a JL there, and I times JL is a minus KL, and you notice in particular that this particular combination is anti-associative. So three things that do not lie on the line are anti-associative, three things that lie on the line are associative. So the algebra in general is a mess. Okay. So what about the things that you know and love from complex algebra still work? In particular, you can make what we still call a complex conjugate. If you have a pure imaginary thing, so it has no real part, then taking the conjugate of it, A bar is just minus A. And once you have this conjugate operation again, you can still define a norm of an octonion, A times A bar, turns out to be a positive real thing, so that's a nice norm, and you get A squared. You can define inverses. And in particular, there's a relationship on the norms. It says if you have two octonions, A times B, the norm of AB is the norm of A times the norm of B. And it's basically that rule, the fact that that rule is true, which allows you to see supersymmetry at some later stage. If you parameterize the superstring equations in terms of octonions, it's the fact that this rule is still true over the octonions that solves three of the four superstring equations when you parameterize them in terms of octonions. Go back to the multiplication rule here a second. There is some freedom in this octonionic multiplication rule. You can switch the order of arrows as long as you switch three, they all point to the same thing. But there's not really a lot of freedom. There's really, in essence, actually there's sort of two octonionic multiplication rules. You can also take all of the arrows and switch them, which is sort of taking left multiplication to right multiplication. And so in some sense, there's a chirality. There's a choice you make when you say this is your octonionic multiplication rule as opposed to some other one that has some chirality inherent to it. Okay, so the octonions are not associative, but there's a weak form of associativity called alternativity, which says that as long as you're trying to as long as two of the three things that you're trying to associate are the same or point in the same octonionic direction, then they are associative. It's only when you have three things that point in different directions that you're trying to control. Okay. Now what we really want to do is think about phases. So there's a version of Euler's formula for the octonions, which says if you can take an octonion and you can write it as a real part and some phase, and so Euler's formula still holds, where now S hat lives on the seventh sphere. It's some pure imaginary unit octonionic direction. So it could be I or J or K or L, or it could be some linear combination of those things as long as it's pure imaginary and unit. And so in particular, there are some nice versions of multiplication that I want you to keep track of. The first one is that if I have this pure phase e to the k theta times an I, if I want to move it through, if I expand the e to the k theta as a cosine theta plus k sine theta, then the k and the I anti-commute. So when I move it through, the phase changes sign. And in particular, if I do this conjugation operation, e to the k phi, e to the minus k phi on each side, if I move this through an I, it becomes e to the minus 2k theta. But of course, if I move it through a real thing, or I move it through, if I move the e to the k theta through a k-like thing, it goes through for free. So the non-commutativity really determines what's happening when you do multiplication by phases. All right, so how does that help us? Now it gets hard, or a little harder. Now, you can think of this octonion X as in a real eight-dimensional space. And so the norm of X in the octonionic sense is just the Euclidean norm. And what we want to do is think about what happens if you do this conjugation operation, AX on AX A bar on an X. And as long as the norm of A is 1, then AX A bar, the norm of that, is still the norm of X. And so any conjugation operation like this lives in SO8, but it actually turns out it lives in SO7, which serves the real part. So all SO7, and it turns out that all SO7 transformations are of this conjugation type, but a little bit strangely. So e to the k theta x e to the minus k theta, I just showed you how to pull that e to the k theta through, actually rotates in the ij plane. Okay, it rotates in the ij plane, but remember ij k, so if I'm conjugating with a k, it rotates in the ij plane, but IJK form of quaternionic space, but it will also rotate in the LKL plane, and it'll also rotate in the ILJL plane. So just these phase transformations don't give you all of SO7. They only give you some subgroup of SO7. What's the resolution? If you want to try and do all of SO7, how do you get the whole thing? It turns out that you actually use the non-associativity to help you out. And so if I conjugate with I, and then I conjugate with I cosine theta j sine theta, and so I'm nesting in this way. I first do one conjugation, and then I do another. It turns out that this particular combination will rotate in just the IJ plane without rotating in these other quaternionic spaces. So you think you don't have as big a group as you want. You like all of SO7. If you just do conjugation, you don't have a big enough group. But because Kaptonians are non-associative, you can conjugate twice with two different things, and there's no way of undoing the parentheses to make that into a single conjugation, and so you get a bigger group than you think you have. Right? And that's sort of the theme to the whole talk is that, and so I hope what I'm doing is convincing you that you shouldn't be afraid of the non-associativity of your Antonians, you should embrace it. Because of the non-associativity, you get bigger groups than you think you do. Oh, that's what this is for. Yeah. Okay. Now, you'll notice that these particular transformations I'm conjugating, I and I cosine theta plus j sine theta, are phases with theta chosen to be pi over 2. When you do these conjugations with theta being pi over 2, you're actually taking things to minus themselves when you do the conjugation operation. So what happens is you start thinking about rotation in a completely different way from the way we normally do. Normally, when we're thinking in three dimensions, if you want to rotate in this red-blue plane here, you say, oh, well, what I'll do is I'll take the axis which is perpendicular to that plane, and I'll rotate around that axis by whatever angle I want to think about. Well, that's a very dangerous way of describing rotations if you live in more than three dimensions. So what is it that you want to do? Say, well, if I want to rotate in this plane, the first thing I will do is take one direction in that plane, say the red direction, pointing straight out at you, and I will rotate around that direction everything else, take everything to minus itself. And that's well defined in any number of dimensions. Do this. Right. Now, take another direction in the plane that I want to rotate, say this one here where my finger is, right? And rotate again everything else around that direction, take everything to minus itself. Now, if I do that very carefully, what happens is the red pen flips to the other side of my finger, right? And I've rotated by whatever angle I had between the two directions that I rotated around, the red pen's gone twice that far. Everything that's not in the plane has gotten the minus sign twice, it's come back to itself. But everything in the plane has just moved by 2 theta. So I'll do it again for you. So you do this. Then you do this. And so you end up seeing rotations as a pair of flips. Okay, so here's the one flip around the I direction, and then here's the second flip around the direction I cosine theta plus j sine theta.
So is the claim that all SL7 transformations can be generated by flips in those two phases with the k, x, e, or minus?
Yeah, well, in fact, all of SL7 can be generated by flips where theta is pi over 2.
Oh.
Okay, but you might have to nest a bunch of them together. So if I want to rotate just in the IJ plane, this one will do it. If I want to rotate in the IJ plane and the KKL plane at the same time, then I can put the KKL on this.
Don't I want to have theta somewhere? What if I just want to rotate a little bit in IJ?
If you want to rotate a little, then you pick this theta to be small.
Yeah, all right, so theta doesn't have to always be
pi. Sorry, there's two thetas up there. The theta is either the KKL line. That one's always particle two. In the yellow box, everything is pure imaginary.
Okay.
Theta in the yellow box is different from the theta.
Okay.
Two lines before. That's two, I'm sorry.
You're right. Okay, so the point is that if you really want to think about, if you're nesting in this way, to take things to minus themselves, you have to take the theta and the e to the k theta to be pi over 2. So you're really doing this. If you want a very small rotation, then you pick these two directions in that plane to be very close to each other.
And that's the value of theta.
And that's this value of theta.
Now that's
that one. Okay, and but notice that then if you want to look at an infinitesimal transformation, if you want to look at the algebra, then you're still doing it in terms of two group operations, a pair of group operations rather than, so you can get around the non-associativity of the Antonians by nesting in this way, but in some sense you sort of destroy the Lie algebra description. You really need to think about the symmetries in terms of the group and not in terms of the Lie algebra. And so a lot of the things that you know and love how to do just sort of fade away on you. You can't do the things you're used to. Or you can, but only with some thought. Okay, other questions? Okay. All right. Now what we'd like to do is think a little bit about automorphisms of these groups. So an automorphism is you want to do a conjugation on X and a conjugation on Y and get the same thing as if you want to do the multiplication on X, Y, and then do the conjugation. And so you want to find a set of A's for which that works. It turns out that because you have associativity over the quaternions, you can do that trivially at any set of any A whose magnitude is 1 will work there, so you're fine. And you get all of that for free in that way. But over the Hopkinsians, because you don't have the associativity, things are trickier. You can't remove these parentheses in the Hopkinsian case to get this A inverse next to that A. And so it turns out that not all Hopkinsians will be automorphisms. All right. And so what is the conditional on an Hopkinsian going to be an automorphism? It turns out that the angle in the phase has to be a multiple of pi over 3. So e to the pi over 3 times one of these s hats, which is any direction in the set dimension, works. And it turns out that group is G2, one of the exceptional groups. And so in some sense, these correspond to different ways of labeling the Antonianic multiplication table. So I could go back to that triangle, and I could just actually switch the names of the labels, what I call I and what I call J and what I call K. So let me convince you that this is a sort of 14-dimensional thing to do, because 14 is the dimension of G2. And so if I have my Hopkinsian multiplication, I have these sort of 7 pure imaginary directions. I can say, if I've sort of got this 7-dimensional space, I can sort of point on the 7 sphere, I can point the I, choose I to be any direction that I want. So on the 7 sphere, there are 6 angles that tell me where I am. So I get sort of 6 choices of where I can put I. And then I can put J. All I know about J is it has to be perpendicular to that. So there are 5 places that I can put that. But I know that I and J multiply together to give me K. So once I've chosen I and J, then the direction of K is fixed. I don't get to pick that one. But then when I get to pick L, the next one, I know that it's perpendicular to I and J and K, but that's all that I know. So there are 3 places that I can put L. And then once I've picked L, everything else is determined by the multiplication table. So I have 6 plus 5 plus 3, and that would be 14 dimensions in my choice of multiplication. Just to get you sort of a little bit intrigued, we know that E&M is related to the phases, to pure imaginary phases. In standard language. And here all of a sudden with the automorphisms, of the octonics, we have things with pi over threes and two pi over threes, and three pi over threes, which are one and minus ones, okay? The charges that live in quarks seem to be associated with these octonionic phases that come from on lattices. That's something where we think we have some hints about where we want to go, but we haven't exactly figured it all out. Okay.
Yeah, it's the same, and that the full automorphism group of the octonians is G.
The full automorphism group of the octonians is G2. But you can think of it as, you can think of G2 as conjugations with these pure phase things that have angle, special angles of pi over 3 and 2 over 3, multiples of pi over 3. There are also other ways of describing automorphisms, but single ones, that's what you get. All right. Now what we'd like to do is build some bigger structures. We've got SO7, there's actually an SO8 in there, but I'm not going to take the time to tell you how the SO8 goes. But let's start looking now at 2x2 matrices over the octonians. In the complex case, relativists are quite familiar with taking TXYZ, the standard Lorentzian coordinates in 3 plus 1 dimensions, and embedding those into a 2x2 complex Hermitian matrix in the following way. And the reason for doing that is that in terms of the matrix, the Lorentzian norm is just the determinant of the matrix. And so you start getting some nice algebraic things going on with your special relativity in terms of what you then want to do is Lorentz transformations are things which need to preserve the determinant. So you can start using a lot of linear algebra. Notice that when you do this, you're writing X as a linear combination of the Pauli matrices. So there's a standard isomorphism between SO31 and SL2C that relativists use all the time. And so instead of writing Lorentz transformations in terms of these 4x4 matrices, you write Lorentz transformations as MXM dagger. And so in particular, this Lorentz transformation, for instance, is written in terms of that M. And as long as these M's have norm 1, they'll preserve the determinant, and any such thing is a Lorentz transformation. What we'd like to do is jack that result up to the octonians. So what we'd like to do is think about an isomorphism between SO51 and SL2H, if you will, and SO91 and SL2O. So it's not quite clear what you mean by SL2H and what you mean by SL2O. So I'm actually going to give you a definition for those two things. But notice that if you do that, actually, let me go back. We have two examples.
Next page.
What's happening over the previous page? There we go. Notice here, what you have is you have your element of your division algebra here. Here it gives you two spatial dimensions. You have a z and minus z on the diagonal that gives you a third spatial dimension. And you have time up down the diagonal. And so out of these complex numbers, you get two dimensions for the division algebra plus two for the things that are on the diagonal. So you're in 3 plus 1 dimensions. If I do the same thing now, and I take this to be a quaternion, then here's 4 dimensions plus 2 is 6. And if I use an octonion here, here's 8 dimensions plus 2 is 10. And so what happens, if you do real numbers, you get 3 dimensions. So what happens is you can do this identification in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions. But for supersymmetry people, 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions are the dimensions in which you can do supersymmetry. Right? It's a very intriguing. So what I want to do now is define for you what I mean by SL2H and SL2O. And I'm going to use the result of how you get the octomionic transformations by guessing. So here, for instance, are the three matrices that rotate in the ZX plane, the XY plane, and the YZ plane in 3+1 dimensions. And now what I want to do is I want to make, moving up to the quaternions and the octonions, so I need more rotations. If I'm up to 10 dimensions, I need SO9-1. And I do that by taking these same matrices, and every place I see I replace it with J's or K's or L's, something like that. And that gives me a whole bunch of things. But remember that it has a tendency to rotate three pairs of things, all of which point to the same octonion. So how do I get around that? What I have here is some subgroup of SO9-1. Just like I have a subgroup of SO7. But I want more transformations. Well, what more transformations can I use? The result for the quaternions has been known for some time. If you take M to be just a phase times the identity, then in particular, if this is a K phase, it will rotate the IJ plane. What you're used to, if you're looking at an MXM dagger kind of thing, you're used to saying, well, if I have a pure phase here, it's just going to pull right through. And it does over the complex numbers. But over the quaternions or the octonions, it doesn't. So these phases that you thought of as just sort of this extraneous thing, I think are left over from some symmetry breaking from 10 dimensions down to 4. Those phases really do something in higher dimensions. And so over the quaternions, the extra rotation that you're missing from just taking these matrices and putting I's and J's and K's in it, the extra one is this pure phase one. But over the octonions, even that isn't enough, because a pure phase like this will flip, if I do it around K, again, it flips I with J, and it flips KL with L, and it flips I with JL. So what do I have to do? Again, I have to nest. And it turns out that you're saved by the non-associativity of the octonions again if you do an MXM dagger, and then you do another one, and here's a particular example, you can end up finding rotations just in one plane. And it turns out then that all of SO9-1 is describable in terms of these nested things. All right, well that's the vector, but we certainly want some spinners in our lives too. So now I'm going to take a spinner, and I'm going to think about it, a spinner as a pair of things in my division algebra, either quaternions or octonions instead of complex numbers. And note in particular that if I take B with B dagger, I get a matrix, I get a vector thing that's associated with this spinner. But notice in particular, because of my division algebra property, the norm of C squared times the norm of B squared minus the norm of CB, because of that division algebra property, this thing has norm 1. So these spinners are all light left. And all left. C squared times B squared minus the norm of CB squared is 0. They're light left. Well, I've shown you how to do SO9-1, how to do Lorentz transformations on the vector. The question is then, how do you do Lorentz transformations on the spinner? And so what you'd like for the spinner is you'd like to do just a single matrix on B, but you would like the transformation on the vector that you get from making BB dagger to be compatible with the transformation that you do on the spinner. It turns out that, again, over the octonions, this isn't automatic. It's not true for all M's, but it turns out to be true for exactly the M's that we've shown you, the ones with these pi or two flips in them. So, you have to be very careful about what you're doing, but if you're exactly careful enough, everything works out the way you want it to.
Okay, so we've had physicists teach us some mathematics, and now you're getting a mathematician trying to teach us some physics. I'd like to give you a sense of what you can do with the octonions when you try and start doing some physics with it. So the first thing I'm going to look at is the Biot equation, so the massless Dirac equation. And here's the Dirac equation sitting right here, which is P mu gamma mu. There's no mass term. equals zero. There's a filing equation, so we get two component spinners rather than four component spinners, and in particular, my gamma matrices are really just Pauli matrices in that context. Okay? This tilde operation that's going on here is related to a dot product. It's sort of buried in there. Algebraically, it's just reverse trace of the matrix. But all I've done here is written down the momentum space massless Dirac equation in terms of now two component spinners, because that's all you need for the massless case. It's just an algebraic equation, momentum space. Some momentum matrix, just a vector in our language, times some spinner is zero. I can do this over any of the division algebras just by adding four Pauli matrices. In fact, you can extend the Pauli matrices to a bigger set with the right anti-commutation rules just by taking the one. Now I've switched here, I've written L instead of I, the standard complex unit. But by taking the standard set of three Pauli matrices plus the identity, and then just adding all the other possibilities by replacing the given complex unit by all the other Archimedeanic units. And so I can do this in any of those 3, 4, 6, or 10 dimensions that go with the different division algebras. Okay. So I want to solve that equation. And again, it's just an eigenvector equation. Just an eigenvalue eigenvector thing with a zero eigenvector. And so in particular, you expect the determinant of the matrix is zero. Well, that's a momentum. It tells you that massless objects move at speed of light. It's a null vector. It's a square of the null vector. And in fact, this equation is very easy to solve. This is a 2x2 matrix. Now, it's Archimedeanic in the general case, but it's Hermitian. Two real things down the diagonal, one Archimedeanic thing and its conjugate on the off diagonal. It's really just a complex matrix. It's only got one degree of freedom, one direction in the Archimedeanic space. And so, in fact, there's not, you can talk about determinants and things of that sort without any difficulty. And in particular, if your momentum is null, it's just some spinner squared. And that spinner is itself a solution of that equation. Put differently, solutions of the Dirac equation have momentum equal to the momentum that you had out in front in momentum space. It's not a terribly profound statement. But here's the direct proof that if I had a spinner and I square it to get the momentum, which is of course null, it's a null vector, and I do this tilde operation, which is reversing the trace, and I simply multiply everything out. And yes, I have to worry about associativity, but alternatively, the weak form saves me here, and I can move the parentheses. I get theta dagger theta, which is a real number, the magnitude of the spinner, on one side and on the other side, and they cancel my zero. It really does solve the equation. It turns out that the general solution of the massless of the violent wave, the massless Dirac equation, is that particular solution times an arbitrary Archimedeanic phase, if you like, Archimedeanic factor. You have to be careful to put it on the right and not on the left. However, I should emphasize that there's only two Archimedeans in any particular solution to this situation. You've got sort of one direction hidden in your momentum, which you use. It's the same direction when you make theta. And then you have a second one, which is your phase. So there's really only two Archimedeans in the solution. Two Archimedeans, you won't have to get a third, but that would give you an associative Archimedeanic subalgebra. The solutions of this equation, which started off Archimedeanic, in fact, are Archimedeanic, although which Archimedeanic space area it could depend on the solution you're looking at. That's important on the back. So here's the same thing written out in terms of the components of the matrices. If your spinner, I'm going to choose the phase where the top piece is real. Here's the complex single axonionic direction from the matrix sitting in there in center. Here's the explicit square of that spinner to get the momentum. And then here's just a rendering of the general solution of arbitrary phase. The phases turn out to cancel up there because you're going to turn out some algebra.
I would just say that the phase way over on the right, either the U hat alpha, if you put that extra phase into psi, the freedom to choose that octonionic phase is exactly supersymmetry. It's not changing the vector when we do that.
And just a math note, the set of solutions, what you're looking at, is the octonionic projective space. The projective space is tough to do over the octonions, and the only reason that's there is that at the tail end of the talk, we're going to see the only other octonionic projective space, OP2. No, not here, so if you're used to thinking, if you know about the hot vibrations, they're also sitting in here. We have a mapping that goes between these guys over here. So this is, if you're doing the complex case, you have two complex numbers and you normalize, you're looking at a free sphere. Whereas over here, you're looking at, forget about the T, you're looking at a two sphere, x surface, y surface, z squared is some constant. This is the operation of going from here to here is a mapping from S3 to S2 with an arbitrary phase. Arbitrary phase up here, and doing it before division algebras gets to the four hot vibrations, not just the S3, S2 one that most people Well, I want to do the Weyl equation. I want to talk about massive particles, and so I need to think about the ordinary Dirac equation. I'm going to use a Weyl representation, and so my gamma matrix is really R, just Pauli matrices. And the Dirac equation, it's just the mass term which couples, if I write a Dirac spinner, a four-component spinner, it's only the mass term that mixes up those two-component spinners. Okay. But this is now a four-component, think of it as a four-component complex spinner. I can repackage it as a two-component quaternionic spinner. I'm just going to take those two pieces and put them together with a K. One of them's got a K in it, one of them doesn't. I'm sorry, point it back. One of them's got a K in it, one doesn't. Same number of degrees of freedom, but now I'm back to a two-component formalism where I can talk about the massive Dirac equation in the language of massless, really six-dimensional, because I'm doing the quaternions, Weyl equation. I've smuggled in the extra degrees of freedom into the quaternions rather than into two extra components. And just to be a little more explicit, I'm taking four-component spinner that's complex, rewriting it in this particular way. It's got a Pauli matrix in it. In this particular way, as a two-component quaternionic object, and if I do that, I can rewrite the standard Dirac equation in terms of a Weyl equation of the form we just saw. But it's just a dictionary translation between the standard four-component Dirac formalism and a quaternionic two-component formalism, but for the Weyl equation. Well, here's our first sort of key idea. Remember that we really think about doing all this over the octonions, but that the complex numbers sit inside the octonions. Okay, so we'll pick a complex unit. We like to call it L, we say I, J, and K for something else, which is in a moment. But so anything I do over the octonions in 10 dimensions, I can always restrict to the complex subalgebra. And whenever I do that, I'm only in four dimensions. And so I can do all this 10-dimensional physics, but anytime I want to do four-dimensional physics, all I have to do is project out everything except one complex, one octonionic unit, which I call the complex unit. And what happens when you do that? Well, remember, so I'm in 6 or 10 dimensions, I don't really care, so we have 20 on a board, we can turn it on a violet equation. The determinant with zero, the null vector, it's massless. But I have a 10-dimensional or 6-dimensional null vector, and I project it into 4 dimensions. I'm throwing away some space pieces. I might get a null vector, I might get a timeline vector. If I study the higher dimensional null case, I get the lower dimensional massive and massless case. I think that's part of the justification, or in fact, all of something I've already said, that I can view the momentum as having a mass term and a timeline piece. And I'm still a higher dimensional null vector. So let's suppose that the mass term points that way. Call that direction k. Typical example. From Sterniana, I've got all the complex momentum you used to have plus a mass term. And I'm just changing my basis, if you like, so the mass term is only in one direction, so the writer can go down. Well, I just repackaged standard Dirac theory into the Fermionic Random for the massless violet equation. I'd like to identify, I'd like to extract for you the standard particle spectrum, where you identify which particles, which of those things, solutions have spin up, spin down, and so forth. But to do that, I have to understand how to do spin in this language. And I just want to touch briefly on the fact that because of the commutativity and associativity issues, the eigenvalue problem with the Eiffelonian is actually very interesting. I don't have a lot of time to tell you all the beautiful mathematics involved with that, but you have to do some things that are a little careful. First of all, when you take your Lie algebra, when you take your infinitesimal rotations, don't put the physicist's extra factor of I in. If you don't know what I is, you've got to really work with the infinitesimal non-Hermitian generators. Don't make them Hermitian by sticking that extra I in. You're very careful how you do that. Second, when you're trying to construct a self-adjoint operator over the Eiffelonians, you've got to make sure that you pick the right self-adjoint operator. And you have to make sure you do the right eigenvalue problem. And in both cases, that's a joke because the right choice is to put extra things on the right. The eigenvalue goes on the right. An extra factor of I that you didn't stick in to your Lie algebra has to show up here on the right. So it really is, you have to choose the right setup to make things work. But if you do it all, and again, it's just a translation of a dictionary translation of a problem you're used to. Here are your spin operators. Okay, again, when you actually go to act on things, you've got this extra factor of L now on the right. Here's the state that's going to turn out to be the spin-up state. And I do want to point out something very pretty, I think, that happens. That state is a simultaneous eigenvector of all three of your rem operators. It's not supposed to happen. However, only one of those eigenvalues is real. Okay, so what's going on here over the Eiffelonians, Hermitian self-adjoint operators do not necessarily have a spectrum that's purely real. The associativity screws up the proof that self-adjoint operators only have real eigenvalues. And so you actually get some extra eigenvalues, but the only real one is the one you expect. And so it's a slight recasting of the statement that you don't have simultaneous eigenstates of the different eigenvector operators. And we're not quite sure whether you can do anything with that. You want to add something?
I just want to say that you're used to these three operators not commuting with each other because the eigenvectors of them are different. Here we're claiming the eigenvectors are the same, but the eigenvalues are not all real. And so the non-commutativity of the operators comes from the non-commutativity of the eigenvalues. And you end up with doing standard quantum mechanics, but in a very sort of non-standard way of thinking about it. And I'd love to talk to some fundamental quantum mechanics people about what the implications of that might be.
Okay, so finally ready to finish the dictionary translation, and then Corinne will come back and finally tell you how to do this Oviatolian problem. Standard dictionary translation looks like this. Bunch of two components, really underlying, think of them four component graph spinners. You've got one that you can identify as spin up, let's call it an electron. Spin up massive, spin down massive, neutrino. How do you make those identifications? Well, the spin properties or helicity properties you get by solving the eigenvalue problem using the operators I just showed you, and then you square them to get their momenta, and you notice that this one, for instance, has a T component, but no Z component, no X component, no Y component, it's at rest. No momenta in the X, Y, or Z direction, it's just an energy and a mass. Whereas down here, this one has sort of T plus Z is 1 and T minus Z is 0, and so it's moving at the speed of light in the Z or minus Z direction. But you can read off the momenta here, and we use those to characterize those. And yes, those neutrinos are massless. Thank you. Back to you.
Okay, so it turns out that what we've shown you is that all of the solutions of the Dirac equation lie in some quaternionic subspace of the octonions. If you look at the quaternionic subspace that has L, which we're thinking of as special by our dimensional reduction, to get from 10 dimensions down to 4, by an L and the K space, you get the seven particles that we just showed you, which have electrons of either spin up or spin down. They have neutrinos, but the neutrinos have only a single helicity to them. They're the right-handedness to it. Right, so you have, here you're automatically seeing the handedness of the neutrinos coming out. If you write down any other pair of quaternions and think of that as a spinner, those are just Lorentz transformations of the ones that we showed you. So those are particles which are moving rather than the particles that are at rest. So every pair of quaternions in that quaternionic space are just one of these. All right. But the solutions are all quaternionic. And we've said L is special, but we haven't said K is special. So the question is, how many quaternionic subspaces are there like this? Well, if we've just shown you what happens with calling K the mass direction, L is special. So we've been using this quaternionic space, but there are precisely two other quaternionic spaces that have L being special. So what do we have? We actually have three copies of electrons like this. We have exactly three generations. So there are three generations in this nice way. And so now it turns out that we've got electrons, we've got neutrinos, we have three generations of them, and if I take any pair of octonionic things that are living in a quaternionic space, that's all you've got, except for one thing that we lied about. We said that there were these things that were massless, traveling at the speed of light that looked like 0k, or looked like k0. There's one more. There's the thing that looks like 0, 1, or 1, 0. So I picked a new letter. This is the Norwegian U, and it's traveling in the z direction. So this thing is the Oz. All right. And what it is a massless particle, travels at the speed of light, but it has no label telling you which generation it's in. And its handedness turns out to be just the opposite of the neutrinos. So our claim is that there's one more thing in the world, like the neutrino, which has the opposite handedness to the neutrino and has no generation structure. Now, we don't know anything about interactions yet. We don't know how this interacts, so we can't tell you how to go looking for it. But our claim is that in terms of the lepton sector, that's all there are. It's precisely three generations. Neutrinos have a single handedness. And there's one other thing with no generation structure and the opposite handedness. Is that sort of a sterile neutrino that you need to get neutrino mixing? Perhaps. Okay, so what are our conclusions from this part of the talk? We've shown you how with just 2x2 revision matrices to get leptons with the correct spin and helicity states. We've shown you that neutrinos have one helicity, and we've shown you that there are precisely three generations. Now let's be a little bit more speculative. What are some of the consequences of the sorts of things that we've been talking about? First of all, everything that we've done so far has been in momentum space. What do you say? That's no problem. To get first, so we've been doing plane waves, basically. No problem. To get from momentum space to position space, what do? You do a Fourier transform. Okay, that's easy. We know how to do Fourier transforms. Except, what do you have to do to do a Fourier transform? You have to multiply by e to the I e dot x. And one of the things that working with the Antonius teaches you really quickly is you've got to ask every time you see an I, you have to see, say, which one do I mean? Well, to get from positions, momentum space to position space, we have to pick an I. Presumably, we want it to be this one that we picked to be special to get us from 10 dimensions down to 4. But if that's special, it means you cannot get to momentum to position space until after you've done the symmetry grading. So it's telling you that 10-dimensional space actually doesn't exist at all. Momentum space, 10 dimensions, it does. But not, there isn't any 10-dimensional space-time at all. That space-time itself arises then as a consequence of the dimensional reduction. Okay. What about... Okay. So, also what we've been doing is true, you know, just at a single point. What we haven't talked about is, you know, you're picking these quaternionic spaces at a point. As you move from point to point, then perhaps 10-dimensional curvature or even curvature in 4 dimensions is rotating those various quaternionic spaces with respect to each other, and perhaps that's what gives you the generation mixing. If that's what's giving you generation mixing, then presumably you see more generation mixing where there's more gravity. So are you seeing generation mixing as you go through the Earth in the neutrino experiments, or as you're tunneling out of the Sun? And is there perhaps no generation mixing at all if you're in flat space? So, what's next? Okay. We still haven't talked at all about interactions. We haven't talked about quarks or color or the SV3. Nor have we really talked about charge because we don't have interactions. This is the work that I've shown you so far is actually pretty old. What we're really working on now is looking at the 3x3 columns and the 3x3 permission matrices. Okay, we're going to talk about that in 5 minutes.
So let me now change gears a little bit. We've made considerable progress just by looking at a pretty traditional structure to speak a little bit about pointing it. Namely, looking at the Dirac equation through the divided equation and looking at it in the context of Penrose states, two component states, which at least are relatives for a near and dear to our hearts. I'd like to ask, what should we do next? I'd like to propose that the answer lies, as Corinne, I believe, said at the very beginning, in the 3x3 formalism, looking at 3x3 Antonionic permission matrices. And this is known as, nowadays, mathematicians call the Albert algebra, it's the exceptional Jordan algebra. It was proposed by Jordan von Neumann and Wigner early on in the early days of quantum mechanics. They had an alternative formulation of quantum mechanics that is equivalent to matrix quantum mechanics, but it used an abstract definition of the multiplication of the operators, things like that. Basically, it was an abstract algebra that had to obey this so-called Jordan identity at the bottom. And they showed in a immediately subsequent paper, they knew right away that this was equivalent to matrix formulations of quantum mechanics in all cases except one. And that's the one. 3x3 octonion. It's not associative. It's the only non-associative example. You have operations on these 3x3 matrices called the Jordan product written with a circle and the Freudenthal product written with a star, which are basically just a dot and cross product, generalization of dot and cross product. One way to see that is to do the very special case where you think about column vectors in Euclidean three dimensions, ordinary real components. You make matrices out of them, 3x3 Hermitian matrices, by looking at UU transpose and VU transpose. And when you do these operations to them, you look at what you get. And so the trace of the Jordan product just gives you the dot product of the two vectors to start with. And the Freudenthal product just gives you that outer square of the cross product. So these are, in a very direct sense, generalizations of the dot cross product that you're used to. What's interesting is that, so the Eytonians are associated with all five of the exceptional Lie algebras. We talked to you about G2. I'm going to mention, I think are the two most important of the remaining ones. In this 3x3 formalism, so I told you we've got this Jordan product, the Freudenthal product, you can construct inner products using those, tracing those things. You get one that's positive definite, one that's not quite. Remember, you're 3x3, you have 3 Eytonians, that's 24 real degrees of freedom. 3 real things on the diagonal is 27. So you have naturally a sort of 27-dimensional Euclidean way of looking at this, and a 26,1 way of looking at this, a Lorentzian signature 26,1. I can't tell you the details of how this would go, but surely the 26 dimensions of the Lozada string the 10 dimensions of the superstring are related through the Eytonians through something to do with that. The interesting groups are not these two, however, but the generalizations of sort of the Gell-Mann matrices, SU3, and then the containing algebras of that, just the special linear group, the invertible matrices, which are very much, so SL2O was the Lorentz group before, and this would have been the rotations. These turn out to be, when you do it right, so-called exceptional Lie algebras F4, F6. F4 is very much a generalization of the rotation subalgebra of the Lorentz group, and this V6 SL3O is very much a generalization of the full Lorentz group. And let me show you a little bit about how it works. But E6 is a popular choice for grand unification theories. It has been for a long time because you can find all of the groups you want inside it. There's SO31, which we've already shown you, and I'll come back to this in a second. But there is, in a somewhat natural way, there's also a U1 and an SU2 and SU3 inside there. It's not quite a cross product that makes each other up, but it's just big enough to have the groups you want. Start thinking about quarks. Our proposal is the thing you want to do is to look at what we'll call super spinners until somebody tells us someone else has used that or something else, which they have. We're going to break up this 3x3 picture into the old 2x2 picture. There's your momentum from before, there's a vector, there's a spinner. And so you've got in this framework vectors and spinners in the same object. Here's our old Lorentz transformations, buried in the 3x3 matrix. Duo Lorentz-like transformation, that's now an E6 transformation. And lo and behold, it does a Lorentz transformation on the vector and a Lorentz transformation on the spinner. So it's combining spinner and vector pieces into a single object. The resulting structure is precisely this Eytonianic projective space OP2, because of the lack of associativity, there is no OP3. Because of the lack of associativity, there is no 4x4 Jordan algebra over that point. Things stop at 3. This is, in a very natural sense, this, in a very natural sense, is the unique largest object that you've got, if you can be sure to do. Nature has made sort of one thing. It's kind of remarkable to me that it seems to be just about big enough to have the rooms in it that you want to do in front of our business.
Can you repeat that statement, or like, what is it that we can't do?
Okay. So, if you, two things. There is no projected space over the F20s beyond this one, three components, which gives you OP2. There is no OP3. You also, if you're trying to make a Jordan algebra, an algebra that satisfies not just, you can make matrices of any size and multiply. But the question is whether they have interesting properties. So the interesting property that I'm counting winds up being this one. The Jordan identity that allows you to do quantum mechanics. This fails for 4x4 permission on 29 matrices. It works for 2x2 and 3x3. Failed for 4x4 data. Over the quaternions or any other division algebra works for any size. That's ultimately at the heart of it. The reason it fails is an associative creation.
So there's no projected space? What does that mean?
You would normally define the projective spaces as an equivalence class where you multiply by some octonionic parameter, but the associativity issues when you try and match three of them together are already very difficult, and it will simply, I don't know how to answer that. The standard definition doesn't work because of the associativity problems, and I believe it's not just that nobody has found a better way to do it, but that there's actually a formal statement that you can't. But I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't have a very sad form of substitute. This is on almost, and I've got one more slide. Let me show it on the next slide. The things that are in that OP2 space are the ones that square to zero under the Freudian Paul product. The things that square to zero under the Freudian Paul product are precisely the things that solve the 10-dimensional Dirac equation. The things that solve the 10-dimensional Dirac equation are automatically quaternionic. Things that are quaternionic naturally break up into these three quaternionic pieces that were identified in generations. If you start with the exceptional Jordan algebra, you're naturally led to the structure we've shown you. We believe that you can go on and find one more piece, last one, okay. If you look at any such matrix, not just the ones that satisfy this equation, then just as you could for complex matrices, you can find out eigenvectors, you can do a decomposition in terms of, if you like, an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors, and any such matrix in that space will have either one, two, or three components here, depending on how many non-zero eigenvalues there are. Last and final wild speculation. Could that possibly be leptons, tesons, and pairings? Thank you very much.
Questions? How are you going to get a gauge theory into this? I mean, we want, you know, interactions, and then we said, well, we want photons and gluons and all that stuff. Right?
So I don't know about gluons. I don't know why that's, there's some interesting things that this suggests about quantum physics. That it's not clear you're ever going to see three quarks in this game. And so I don't really want to get into gluons at this point. But interactions, I wish I knew. The problem is, I learned how to do interactions in weather space, in position space. And I don't know how to do them in weather space.
Yeah, I think what I was really trying to convince you of earlier is that when you do this octonormal language, because of the necessity to nest you're really driven away from the algebra description, and you end up looking at the group. And so we don't really know how to do the standard kinds of things.